Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the annual report work group of the HITECH. We will get started today. Brief roll call. We have Carolyn Peterson, Christina Caraballo, and Brett Oliver. Erin Mary will be joining us here a little bit late. So with that, I will turn it over to Carolyn to get us started.
Thanks, Lauren, and good morning, good afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are. We're getting back to our annual report work after a nice 6 weeks off in the summer. I hope everyone had a good holiday and is rested up and ready to go. Go to the next slide. So this is our agenda for the day. I think it looks pretty similar to what we did in previous year and month. Start out with our looking at our schedule and then discuss the landscape analysis section for the upcoming annual report. We will talk more about developing the annual report. We'll do a public comment period and then go through our next steps and adjourn the meeting. We have the next slide, please. So believe it or not, we've actually already accomplished 3 of our 9 meetings, and after today, we'll be almost halfway through in terms of the number of meetings we do. That seems pretty amazing to me. We are going to start working on the draft and discussing the landscape section today, and then we will continue to work on that in meetings on October 8, November 26, and December 13. And then in January and February, we will be presenting this draft to the HITECH for review and comment. Next slide, please. And then here's what it looks like in terms of bringing our work to the full HITECH. We will have a status update during the September 17 meeting in person. We will have a update on the virtual meetings on October 16 and November 13. Hopefully we won't be meeting with full HITECH in December. And then in January and February, we'll be reviewing and approving the full draft. Next slide, please. So let's dig into the landscape analysis. This is kind of in the middle of the report overall. We're going to use pretty much the same structure we had last year, except that we will now have a progress area. The next slide, please. So our instructions, I'm going to go to the draft landscape analysis document, and for each of the subsections, consider whether the subsection addresses what it's supposed to or what we think that it should address. Consider any additions, anything we want to delete, or any changes to the text or anything else. If there are additional sources or documents or videos that you think should be referenced, it's a good time to pass that along to Michelle. And we also want to think about how the topic placement lines up compared to previous documents and previous subsections. So with that, let's head into the next section, please. Next slide. So looking at the federal activities section in the draft landscape analysis, we've got ONC's regulation for the 21st Century Cures Act. This is info blocking, price information, certification enhancements, application, programming interfaces, and the U.S. core data for interoperability. We've got the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement version 2. We want to highlight the key changes from between those versions. We've got CMS's interoperability rule, in particular key provisions that impact priority target areas for us. It could be things like hospital notification requirement, the payer-patient APIs, and other things. And then kind of the soup to nuts federal activities section, like the provider burden report, the OCR HIPAA request for information. The next slide, please. So let's start with the priority target area of interoperability. Is that the background and the current state? Information exchange, cross-network exchange, integration of data from multiple external sources, HL7, FHIR standard, and health IT support for opioid epidemic response. So what are we thinking about this area with regard to the draft landscape analysis?
This is me. This is Aaron. Question for you. Should we talk about anything on here about the RCE or anything around TESCA, or should we leave it really at a higher level health information exchange, particularly since RCE was selected yesterday with care quality? Is that worth starting to mention, or do we want to leave it more high level?
That's in the TESCA comes up in the federal activities.
Okay.
I'm trying to map where we are in the slides to the skeleton we put together. This right here, what section is this in the report?
Oh, goodness. Let's see. It's 21 pages.
Sorry. No, page 7. Sorry.
I looked at it the other day, and I've already forgotten the layout. So. Oh, dun, 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 dun.
It's page 7.
Okay.
But to Aaron's point, I think we might have bypassed the federal activities, and with the REC being announced, it might be something we want to add to this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
So in the report, before Carolyn, you said you're good with going up.
With adding.
Perfect.
Yeah, as you say.
So
as you
I've got it in front of me if you want me to just say what it's in there since it's not in the slides.
Sure.
It's under the landscape analysis, there's a heading with the federal activities, and it has cures with some items under with cures. I can read them really quickly. Information blocking, price information, certification enhancements, APIs, and USCDI. And then there's the trusted framework and common and deep agreement with some of the key changes that have been updated. And then we've got another heading with CMS's interoperability role and some other federal activities. But nothing, no mention of the REC in here.
It just may be worth noting, especially since that's been decided and publicized, something for us to think about. Because I think as the RCE, as they work along the path they've been drawn out per 21st Century Cures and the proposed rule, you know, there's going to be things that they got to work through, right? Interoperability challenges, whatever else. So it may be worth putting on here something just to track. And as that goes along, we add to that because it'll bring up other discussion points invariably that we have to work through.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe just like a heading right now with a placeholder, considering it was just announced yesterday.
That's right. In our
draft.
And we might want to reference it also in the progress update section as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that would be a place to discuss it particularly, but it's worth noting that that was, you know, the version was updated this year and the award made and what's happened to date so far by the end of the year, if the contract's been signed or whatever specifically has happened, it shouldn't be hard to just drop that in.
I'm good with that. That's great. Thank you.
Let's see.
This is Michelle. If we go back a slide, we may want to talk through other items that were in that section around the federal activities while we're in that area.
Okay.
So just if anybody wants to bring anything up.
Oh, it was already in there. Sorry. That's the area I was reading. Sorry about that.
Is there anything in here? Let's see here. Interoperability rule, trust exchange. I know that we had talked about this when we, especially the TEFCA and other discussions that we've had around third-party API access and appropriate use. I know that that came up particularly in the work groups for TEFCA and for information blocking. Is there anything worth noting on that? Because I know a lot of work has gone into US CDI as well as, again, appropriate access, or is that for later sections, you think?
Yeah, I think that does come up later. There's a patient section. We get into policy and trust issues around APIs. So just to remind people, the federal activity section is different this year because there wasn't a lot more activity. So we pulled those out, and they were much more cross-cutting, so they didn't fit squarely. They'd be very piecemeal if we tried to address it within each priority target area. So we grouped those together. And tell us if it's not working, because we can definitely switch it around again. So it's hard to read sequentially through and think you're tackling all the federal activities in one spot and then all the patient access stuff in another spot. It will be sprinkled kind of throughout because it does overlap. But in general, we were trying to pull together some of the federal activities that were key and, you know, high, you know, top of mind for the industry and tackle those first as cross-cutting discussion points and then dig deeper into each target area. And then the target areas tend to be more, you know, beyond just the government work. It'll include a lot of industry activity as well.
This is Brett. I thought it was a great draft, really well written. I would add one thing to the opioid epidemic response in terms of what Health IT has done. It's really allowed for clinical decision support in managing opioid use or abuse in patients that you couldn't have in a paper world. And then we talked a little bit about querying PDMPs and things like that, and that's part of it, but it's really more encompassing about more complete clinical decision support at the point of care that you couldn't do without Health IT, some of the things that have been regulated.
Great points, Brett. Well, what do we want to add then to the opioid component on this then? Just about the.
It was well written. I just would add or kind of modify. I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, but just that it talked about a specific, you know, PDMP querying and which is definitely helpful. But what's even more helpful is when you take that information that's discrete and you provide it to me in something that's actionable, which we're now able to do. And, you know, not everywhere, but it's incredibly helpful to remind someone, for instance, that this patient's on a particular morphine equivalent dosage of narcotics and they don't have naloxone, sort of an antidote for accidental or purposeful overdose. That patient doesn't have that prescribed. Would you like to prescribe it? That kind of decision support right at the point of care is transforming some of the patient's interactions.
Okay, I'm good with anything there if you guys want to add to that, but to the degree of it, on this page, I'm looking at it, Michelle, I can't think of anything else to add to it right now.
Yeah, I can't either. I'm sitting here staring at it, but I'm not coming up with any other omissions or anything else we should put there.
Okay, should we move on?
Let's do it.
Do you want me to pick this up from here,
yeah,
Carolyn?
Yeah, go for it.
All right, sure, no problem. All right, so interoperability here, the current state, we have patient matching verification, you know, a lot of the new initiatives with machine learning, referential matching. I can tell you that in this space, this is very still developing, right? We've tried a number of solutions here at UT. It's been interesting, but it's still difficult without some sort of unique strategy that everybody agrees to. With SDOH, social determinants, we have sort of adding some things in here around that because we realized they could be used to identify patient-specific needs, continue to enhance patient engagement, share information across healthcare and social service organizations. We spoke about this at the last HITECH, in person, about SDOH and even things around patient-reported outcomes. There's a whole lot in this space that's growing. So from an interoperability perspective, there'll be everything from standards around SDOH to what does it actually mean and what the definition is at some point. Any comments or heartburn around this?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there's any cross-pollination here with AI and FDA's paper put out for comment back in June about how to regulate AI that learns itself and changes its own algorithm on the fly, as opposed to the sort where humans work things out and go in and reprogram.
That's a great point.
That may have some effects on the SDOH, but I'm not sure that really necessarily fits right here best.
No, but I think those are elements, right? So it's almost like appropriateness of SDOH for further algorithm or machine learning or whatever else, right? Because, well, you know, we're doing a lot with SDOH here in Texas, and not all data is equal when you look at SDOH. So, you know, what's clinically relevant versus what's not? I doubt Brett wants every bit of information from an SDOH, but it may be important looking longitudinally. But when making a clinical diagnosis, is it the right data he needs? I don't know, right? So I think there's some element of appropriateness, just like we were talking about third-party access. What is SDOH usage, right? So those rules of the road, which I haven't seen anything hard and fast about.
Yeah, well, that was just June when FDA was taking comments, so I haven't seen any movement forward on that draft as yet.
Okay, well, that's a good point, though. We should definitely track it. Any other comments on this page?
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking about of areas that we could possibly put in here would be something around consent management. I think that it supports a number of these areas when we start looking at sharing patients' data across different organizations and even patients' access to information. So if you think about it, it touches everything around sensitive data, social determinants of health, patient-generated health data, behavioral health initiatives. I think it's a really important piece that we might want to just give a quick snapshot of where we are in it.
That's a great point. And let me ask a clarifying question. With consent management, do you also include that to also mean release of information or just consent of use?
I think it can be both.
Right. I just think I know we've been talking about consent management and whatnot at the HITECH level for a while, but as I dig into it and I start applying what we do here in the real world, there's a very clear difference, particularly when you look at like research. So consent is truly consent, but you know, release of information is a whole nother dimension. So it may be worthwhile being specific for the purpose of this report.
I think that's great, and I think putting both of them in and highlighting the differences is important.
Yep, exactly.
That would add some clarity too.
Yep. It's becoming very murky. It really is, particularly the blending of research and clinical, you know, operations and it's all patient data, right? But as I tell folks all the time, one consent is not one to rule them all. You have to be explicit and deliberate with the patient and explain exactly what's going on and get their permission. It's their data. So to me, it may be worthwhile us breaking it down, this report, and being very crystal clear with folks what we mean.
And we might
even... Would that be a good... I'm sorry, Karen, go ahead.
I was going to say we might even want to also bring up a discussion of terms of use, because for apps and other things, very often the terms of use is functioning as the de facto consent.
Yep, you're exactly right. Agreed. Brent, what were you saying?
Well, along those lines, I wonder if defining what de-identified data means, because I think that gets used quite a bit. And I think as we saw with that case, like was out of Chicago, where you were able to use social media to take this de-identified data and pretty much could tell who it was. And maybe that's terms of use. Maybe that, I'm not sure where that falls. And we've talked about that a little bit before, but it seems like there's a move in the industry to amalgamate data. And, you know, the promise is always, don't worry, Baptist Health, Brett Oliver, it's de-identified. What does that mean? Right? What does that mean? If you give me enough data, you might not give me their name, but I can tell you it's your address and your birthday and that type of discussion. What are we going to call BS?
I think that's a great point, Brett. And actually, you know, I asked this rhetorical question that perhaps additional guidance is needed to be given by the OCR on what does de-identified really mean? And not just for the purposes of where I can identify you from a HIPAA component, but what does it really, really mean, right? Because when someone says de-identified, the word is, I can't, no matter what I do, reconstruct it's supposed to be Aaron. But in reality, it's, let's make sure that we don't run afoul of HIPAA and that we are doing our due diligence, but that this can't be constituted a breach if we have an issue. So I think there needs to be some additional, that's my personal thoughts, there needs to be some additional guidance given at some point. What is the fair use of de-identified data? What kind of consent is needed to be used with it? You can't just do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, I agree. Because there is, again, there's a huge movement. The power, you know, behind AI and machine learning is bigger and bigger data sets. And even, you know, somebody like Epic, that we're an Epic shop, you know, they're developing their Cosmos, and it's all about having this huge mass of 250 million patients that are all, quote, de-identified, but so you can gather clinical insights from it, which that's great. But what do you mean by de-identified?
Right.
I think I understand with Epic what we're talking about, because they've specifically defined the data points that they're going to collect. But I hear that term tossed around a lot, and I think getting guidance on what that truly means, at least from the government's perspective, would be helpful.
Yeah, agreed. I totally agree. The industry is awash in data. But is it right to use? Is it appropriate to use? We keep coming back to that appropriateness, right? So I think it's great to have all these highways and everything is needed, desperately needed, but we definitely need some rules of the road. Otherwise, everybody's going to be driving whatever they want, whatever speed limit down the road. So, all right. Any other points on this slide, or are we go to the next slide? All right, let's move on. Next slide, please. All right, so background area here, again, my favorite, privacy and security. Current state, a lot of protections for data outside of the HIPAA framework, 42 CFR Part 2, and I keep mentioning FERPA. We've got a lot of considerations there. Also Title 10, I would add to that as well. Interstate data exchange and privacy considerations, the implications of the Privacy Act, California Privacy Act of 18, and then GDPR and the Privacy Shield. Any other current state stuff that's going on that we should call into account right now? I mean, I saw a litany of new laws passed at a state level. Like even here in Texas, our recent session that just ended, there's a number of new privacy laws, but I mean, that's on a state-by-state basis, but across the country, I haven't heard of anything, I haven't seen anything additional. I don't know if you guys have.
It seems to me that I saw something about Washington State stalling. They were trying to do something earlier, but I think it's a bit challenging still.
Yeah. And I bet there'll be stuff that comes out in future, you know, Congress or whatever, but to the degree of it, I haven't seen anything percolating, so. Okay.
I don't know how realistic this is. But is it possible to do kind of an overview of the states and some of the differences in privacy and security laws or similarities that we're seeing? And I think that's a big lift. I don't know if we can do it for this, but just something to consider and maybe something we want to add to, we can do a quick research on it, but then maybe something we want to add to our list of kind of future things to work on.
Is the goal there to just highlight the disparity between the states that, that exists, or what do you think, what are you thinking that would help us put in the limelight?
No,
what do you?
I know, like when I was working with Get Real and consumer data apps, it was kind of like, how do you start parsing sensitive data and how do you know different regulations across the different states? That's kind of where I was starting to think, but a resource guide or something to better understand the differences in privacy and security and how data is shared at a very high level could be helpful for us to better understand the barriers that we're going to have for kind of state-to-state data sharing. Again, I think it's something I started to kind of dabble into looking at a couple of years ago, and it's a lot of work. So, like I said, I'm not sure if it's good here, but if we have some kind of high-level things that we can start putting in a little bit of information that we can gather and then start to see if it's something that we really do need to look at more. I'm sure it's something the RCE will need to look at, and I just think it's going to become more and more important.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's, Michelle, maybe there's surely a document has to be floating around somewhere that people have done that correlation, right?
Yeah, I think we could look, like do a quick scan, see what's out there. It might not be the place work group to dig deep and do the analysis and come up with a guide, but we can definitely recommend, you know, where that's needed and point people in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Great thought.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, let's go on then. Next slide, please. All right, patient access information, current state, patient control data collection, access and sharing, policy and trust issues for APIs, or some of the issues I'm dealing with, companies who still don't want to use APIs, which is just beyond me. Note this has been included in temporary cross-cutting subsection, federal guidance supporting implementation with OCR, concerns about monetization and use of data collected via APIs for non-treatment purposes, goes back to, again, appropriate use, fair use, and then the use and sharing of patient-generated health data, PGHD, which is very interesting if you read that was it a New Yorker or the New York Times article on sharing information with a catch? I don't know if you saw that on Sunday, but there's a lot of question marks around PGHD and what does it really mean to share that data. So I think, Carolyn, you had a lot of foresight last year putting this on here as we track it. I think the industry is realizing how deep that rabbit hole goes, per se.
Yeah, that was a New York Times article. It's gotten a lot of play this week. It's kind of like the same thing coming back around again and again and again.
Are you referring to the one that's like, when apps get your medical data, your privacy may go with it?
Yeah, that one. Yep.
That's funny.
Which is interesting, right? So just very interesting stuff. But it is something that, again, it goes back to consent and informed consent and a fair use, I mean, the whole nine yards, right? That whole thing we just spoke about. So it just keeps reiterating itself.
Yeah.
All right. So did we leave anything off of this thing with APIs?
Thinking about how genomic data fits in now that testing is getting so much cheaper and it's just becoming so much more mainstream, but I don't see a good fit in here for it. I mean, it's obviously data collection, access, sharing matters, but I don't know that we need to call it out differently from any other kind of data. under
that? No, although I would say that, I keep saying this, and I, as many forums as I can, these companies like 23andMe are not a covered entity. They don't fall under the auspices of HIPAA. And I really applaud the FDA and others recently issuing guidance to tell folks stop, you know, stop promising cures to every disease because of genomic profiling, because it's not going to happen. But there's got to be something done about this gray space of companies like genomic companies, things like that, that are not covered entities. It's just got, there's got to be at some point we've got to come to a decision point on these guys.
Yep, I agree.
All right, next slide. All right, emerging issues. This will be the fun stuff. All right, Internet of Things. We talked about this in briefly, but the connectivity of various objects, including appliances, devices, wearables, and sensors to the Internet or other networks, the potential application in healthcare, such as remote monitoring, medical device integration, smart pills, and smart facilities, security risks increase as IoT objects become more integrated with health IT system. I can tell you that I had a meeting this morning with a company that's doing this and actually building all-in-one sensor to hang in a room to look at things like hand washing, dispensing, and identification of patients. It's actually amazing, but I think all these things become definitely in scope that have to be considered, and it definitely takes a lot of conversations with legal and compliance. So clarity is going to be needed around IoT and health in the very, very near future. Digiceuticals. This is the use of digital apps in a formal role of treating a disease. Example of one large PBM has introduced its own digital health formulary that includes a curated set of digital apps for payers and patients. And I think you're seeing every day news of new apps that are FDA certified that can help cure insomnia or help with pregnancy tracking or whatever else. And then right after that, you'll see an article about another similar app that had a health breach or had a data breach that now impacted so many X number of patients or was sending data without permission to Facebook or other places. So, you know, there's a lot of gray around digiceuticals as well. You know, what is the governance function around this, and what is the regulation and responsibility to patients? Any comments or questions on this slide?
I'm feeling like digiceuticals is maybe a broad term that at some point will bear some breaking into different things. I mean, there's some that are more for entertainment, and the data doesn't go anywhere, and you just kind of play with it. But eventually, there will also be one with a category of types of apps that send data to providers or PBMs or the pharmacist or something. But I'm not sure how that really fits into this document. Maybe it's something for next year.
Like a category of digiceuticals, so different categories?
Well,
so like FDA certified or not FDA certified? I mean, I don't know how you do that.
I mean, to me, digiceuticals doesn't say, the term digiceuticals doesn't say anything different than the term apps.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're still at the beginning of this, that it's not yet a market. It seems like digiceuticals, the functionality will rule some things in and some things out.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it will just be cool stuff that you find in the App Store that aren't really digiceutical.
I see what you're talking about. Or something prescribed by like Brett for a patient.
Yeah, I'm not expressing this well, but I'm feeling a lack of differentiation between digiceutical and app.
See, when I think digiceutical, I think a certified app that's been FDA blessed to help treat insomnia. That's one I just saw recently. I was like, oh, that's interesting, right? That could literally be prescribed by a health system for patients that have sleep apnea or whatever, if they so choose to. Or a patient could self-prescribe. I guess you could download from the App Store and pay them money or whatever. But I guess there's some level of, like, has a provider blessed this and has the FDA blessed this? That's really the only bumpers that I'm aware of for apps.
Yeah.
I mean, Brett, what do you think? What do you think as a doctor when you say digiceuticals? Does that mean anything to you?
I just think maybe a subset of apps that I'm actually prescribing or directing. We were just talking about this today in terms of from a digital footprint for our organization, the ones that we do want to prescribe that have been vetted, whether it's through the FDA or just our own vetting process, a place to put those so we can, you know, point parents. Aaron comes to see me, I want to prescribe this app. But, you know, you go to a certain place and it's already available for you and been vetted. So I think of it as sort of a subset of an app.
Good point. Okay. So maybe pointing out this is an emerging landscape. I mean, it's already on emerging issues, but there's potential for further refinement on it, right? Just like with IoT, but really with this too.
Well, the market is immature.
Right.
It's got a way to go. But next year, we'll have lots more to say about it.
I'm sure we will. I'm sure we will. It'll be the next unicorn market or whatever buzzword we hear next. All right. Next slide. All right, continue.
Before we move on,
yes, ma'am.
Just for the IoT, in case people were wondering, last year we had it in the interoperability section. And privacy and security last year, but this year we saw more use and spread of it, and so now interoperability is more of a concern for that topic. So that's why it got pulled out to be in an emerging issue section right now. But we could handle it in a different way. But I just wanted to point out that change from last year.
It makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. Okay. Let's talk about sociogenomics. Sociogenomics is a scientific discipline that attempts to find genetic basis of social behavior and its evolution. Basically, the data sets can now be combined to create new knowledge, which could both offer benefits, like predicting disease risk, and cause harm, like discrimination. I think this is definitely an emerging issue, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Because again, a lot of these genomic companies fall out of the realm of a lot of things. And then machine learning, the process, again, by which a computer is able to improve its own performance by continuously incorporating new data into existing statistical models. This could result in insights from data, which could assist the discovery of new drugs, existing drugs, patient matching, diagnoses, and treatment recommendations. However, again, existing biases in the data sets of the system is trained, which could be perpetuated. So the machine learning component, I think, is really important to highlight. We're seeing that, I mean, I'm seeing that specifically when it looks at oncology and detection of various cancers and having to ask the question, where was this data trained, essentially, that created this algorithm to spot a malignant tumor in a breast or whatever it may be. So there are a lot of biases because then you got to look at the population of data set to say, okay, who were the patients, right? Was this an appropriate makeup of the population to create this algorithm? There's so much of this out there that I personally could appreciate the machine learning thing being on here. So, and it's very important. What else are we missing on these two bullets?
The whole issue of how we deal with AI that teaches itself and makes its own changes, and how do we regulate that? How do we know what that's doing? What's the standard for being able to reverse engineer that to do what we've done? Or do we want to reverse engineer it? I mean, I would think that's a useful ability, but of course I'm not an engineer, so I can be looking for something that's not there.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of it may be patent protected, right? If it's patented and protected, I mean, how much, what's that give and take between do no harm and enforcing patent protection so you don't have to lift up the curtain? I mean, I don't know, right? And this goes back to something that Brett's been talking about for months, which is he's a doctor. He's got to trust an algorithm to tell him what to do. It's his license. It's his responsibility to make sure that the patient is good.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's just a new paradigm to trust something that's proprietary, maybe not even copyrighted, just proprietary, and that's part of your agreement with this company. How do you handle that when something bad inevitably goes wrong?
Right, and how can you tell what the culprit was, right? When you do your root cause analysis on, a near miss, how do you even begin to interpret that when it's in a black box, per se?
Yeah. How does it get better? If this AI is getting better, somehow is it getting better? Because there are operational decisions that then come from that to make your operations better.
Right. Okay. What else on this list? Anything else?
I can't think of anything today.
I can't either. I do want to. I do at some point, I really appreciate this slide and like I wish you could like put it in bold and like asterisk or whatever, but we've got to somehow in healthcare figure out a way to remove biases out of data sets, like for everything, right? Whether it's socioeconomics, whether it's machine learning, with whatever, like we have to be fair and we have to be universal as possible. And I feel like healthcare, for whatever reason, a lot of these companies are doing great work, but they're just not considering that. They're just like gobble up all the data you can without thinking about the universality of it. And healthcare is everybody, it's all of us. So I don't know. At some point, that's going to come to a threshold.
Yeah,
and it's a great point. Really is.
All right, next slide. All right, sharing of large media files. Oh yeah, this is the one you brought up, this Carolyn, and I totally agree with you. How do we share things like audio and video recordings and photographs, and often stored as unstructured data, and do not yet have related interoperability standards? And large media files cannot be shared electronically among providers or accessed by patients. I should say cannot be shared easily. You can share them, but you'll probably break every rule in the book if you have to do it. but it's very difficult. And again, the standards really don't exist out there for a lot of this stuff. Is there anything more we want to add to this, or is it pretty self-explanatory?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, like if I hear the word vendor neutral archive one more time, I'm just going to pull my hair out. I mean, like, that's not the way to solve this problem, right? So there's so much needs to be done from a standards perspective first. Okay, next slide. All right, this is the plan for the development of the high tech report for 19. Next slide. This fall, we will edit drafts of the landscape analysis section, like we just spoke about. The gap analysis of recommendations, we'll be presenting the overview and the high-tech progress sections, and of course the draft report sometime November, December timeframe. So if you all recall, last year was our first time getting it together. The ONC team was absolutely heroic and did an amazing job of keeping us on the straight and narrow, make sure we kept it to goal, we got it out in time. But this year we did start earlier, thanks to, again, great work with the team working on that. So we do want to try to wrap this up by right after Christmas, you know, first part of the new year, and then go into the next fiscal year. Next slide. All right, so before we get to the comment section, any comments from the team? Regarding timeline, regarding things we spoke about, anything on your mind?
I feel like we've really gotten a pretty comprehensive wrap on these topics.
I would agree. I think we're going to learn some things with the rules being finalized and with the exciting work with TEFCA now that we have an RCE to partner with. That's a great RCE, so I'm excited. So I think we'll come up with some good stuff for this year. Brett, Christina, what do you guys think?
I'm good. I really was impressed with the document.
And Christina, this flows better to you? Because I know last year you were doing a great job of keeping us in check on flow. Does the sections make sense? Does it add up? Does it logically speak?
Yeah, I think it looks good. I think we kind of figured that out last year and can kind of move with it this year.
Okay. I just wanted to sanity check. Good.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Well, then, if we're all good with that, do we want to go to comments?
Sounds good.
All right.
Let's do it. Operator, can we open the line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thanks, operator. Any comments in the queue?
Not at this time.
Okay, I'll turn it back to our closing remarks.
Yeah, I'll say something and I'll just pass over to you, Carolyn. I did want to comment also, I think, at some point, maybe not this section, but at some point in the report, and I think, Brett, you were sort of highlighting this around the opioid item. You know, University of Texas is working with State of Texas, HHS, on the opioid epidemic and a number of initiatives that I even personally signed on to help because I think they're really, really important. And as I've learned about the landscape of what's happening with the opioid crisis and stuff, there's a lot there, that technology can help, a lot there that all of us as technologists and healthcare providers and whatnot can help. And I think we would do it right by thinking about how do we suss out some of those items, like the case in point that a lot of the EMS folks have an electronic medical record that didn't fall into the standards that the provider organizations had to do. So therefore, they're doing a lot of manual documentation or literally writing on the back of their glove notes about the patient that they then type in later on. I think there's so many areas that are ripe for opportunity that could help really advance things like how do we deal with the opioid crisis. So if it's in this report, if it's in a subsection, if it's something for a later work group, the more I learn about it, the more I'm just like, we've got to help fix this. There's got to be an area here where high tech can help give recommendations to get in front of some of this stuff. That's my two cents.
And I'll just follow on with that I'm starting to see in media discussion of other types of prescription drug abuse and like the meth crisis, for example, specifically some information about how that's kind of fallen off the radar as people look at prescription opioids and the diversion around all that, but that there are other substances that are leaving their marks in communities. Just thinking about what the technology, how the adaptations might be made to start looking at some of those things when we've resolved some of the issues around the opioid crisis.
That's right. I think technology can help alleviate the stigma around some of this, right? And make it an even playing ground. We're trying to take care of everybody. So.
Yep.
All right.
So I think that's a wrap. It was great to have this conversation today. And I'm looking forward to the next parts of the report and our work next month.
Great. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Just a quick check. Any other comments that came in?
Okay. No comments at this time.
Okay. All right. We will adjourn, everyone. Oh, sorry.
Can I ask one more question really quickly? I completely forgot. It's on our calendar for after the high tech meeting to meet. Are we still doing that?
This is Michelle. We're in progress of correcting that invitation. I think we're getting together over lunch instead.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to confirm.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's a reasonable question. We are still working on clearing that up, but we're planning on a lunch get together. Rather than a formal meeting, it's a get together.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, great. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.